I just want to personally thank our dear friend, Mrs. Roseanne Polanski, and her entire family, her children, Sari and Shlomo Drazin, Nanette Polanski, David and Yehudi Polanski, and Ben Matisyahu and Rivka Polanski, who have graciously sponsored once again this entire day today, all the learning that's going to take place throughout the day today, in memory of their beloved husband and father, Joe Polanski, Reb Yisrael Yosef Meir, Ben Reb Yaakov Shlomo Zichron Livracha, whose yard site is on the 11th of Tevet, which of course is this coming Shabbat. And for the past number of years, the Polanski family has kindly sponsored not only the entire day of learning, but when we were together at the OU Israel Center, they sponsored a break fast at the conclusion of the fast. Of course, this year, for two reasons, we're not going to have a break fast. Number one, we're not gathering together in person. And number two, because the fast is the only fast that can possibly, with the exception of Yom Kippur that falls, sometimes even on Shabbos, that we would fast on an Erev Shabbos. And so the fast is tomorrow, so we won't be able to have the break fast together for two reasons. Number one, because it'll be our Suda Shabbos. And number two, because unfortunately we're still in our COVID reality, which we hope we'll see a conclusion to very soon, and that we'll be able to return once again to in-person classes in the OU Israel Center. So I just, on behalf of all of us, I want to thank Roseanne is here with us and her entire incredible family for allowing us to discuss every year to partner in this special tribute to Joe of blessed memory. And it's a particular treat this afternoon for me to introduce my friend and teacher, Rabbi Neil Winkler, who not only is a beloved faculty member of OU Israel, but had the schus to know Joe Polanski personally, and therefore will not only share with us his usual inspirational Torah, but also a few words of reflection about Joe, blessed memory. And Rabbi Winkler's topic today is, why are we still fasting? So without further ado, Rabbi Neil Winkler.
Yisrael Yosef Meir Ben Yaakov Moshe, Joe Polanski. I have many memories about Joe Polanski, but I'll begin with a memory of over 50 years ago, which is when I first met him. And the memory I have is not directly from him, but about him. It was one of the Shabbatot where after our engagement, my wife and I had come to visit North Belmore. That Shabbat, I was walking home with the rabbi of the Young Israel of North Belmore, a shul that my father-in-law, Baruch Hashem, also was able to literally get together and to establish in North Belmore. The rabbi is one that you know, at least certainly for a while here at the OU, Rav Moshe Gorelick. And we were walking home, and he knew that I was an Erev Rav. I wasn't quite the rabbi yet, but I was looking into a life of the rabbinate. And being an educator as he was, and as I as well was going to be, he once told me, he said, you know, the yeshiva today are wonderful, and they really are teaching at a very high level, but they had one simple problem. And he spoke not only as an educator, but also as a Rav of a Kehila. He said, too many yeshivot are so busy trying to create the great, great Vilna Gaon, the great Gedolim, the great learners, that they fail sometimes to create Balabatim. And it's something that amazingly remained in my mind for all these years. And then he said, I was lucky because I have someone like your father-in-law, like my father-in-law, Dr. Harold Nirenberg, Alav HaShalom, and I have Joe Polanski. And this is a story of Joe. Joe was one who was totally community-oriented. He was chesed-oriented. He was family-oriented. He was always close to my in-laws, that family. They lived around the corner in North Belmore. And he was one who not only was involved with the shul, but one who had tremendous respect for Rabbanim, and for the davening itself. In fact, his brother would come for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and daven in the Young Israel of North Belmore. And he was a person to really look at and admire and even model yourself. I recall that even when he was raising his children, he decided to continue education, took his master's degree when things were not that easy to do, when you're that busy. But he did so. But perhaps the greatest impact he had on me was just recently. My father-in-law was niftar about 6 years ago. 15 years ago. And leaving my mother-in-law, may she be well and live long, in a house, large house, it's empty except for herself. And every single Friday night, Joe would come home from shul. And I think often, I think Roseanne, you joined him. And together they would go into my mother-in-law's house and they would say Kiddush for her. And they talked to her. And the very, very deep loneliness that she felt was at least for a while taken away, as she knew she had friends just around the corner who not only spoke to her and thought she was nice and had a relationship with her, but who took care and to be sensitive enough to understand what she must feel like on a Shabbat. To this, I am eternally grateful. I recall seeing Joe and Rosanna on the street, I think it was almost right in front of the Israel Center on the Keren HaYesod, in one of those summers when I came to visit. And the joy that he had, living here now, having made Aliyah, was just clear. He was a very special individual. And I am honored to be able to give this shiur in his memory. Yehei tehei nishmato tzrura b'tzrur hachayim. V'ha'Yisraeli b'chlal yishkach machatzavto v'yachshov le'ezrach ra'anan yachshov ki Berlin hi Yerushalayim az yavo ruach so'a b'sa'ar yakor oto migiz'o yanichehu l'goy merachok Asher lo lamad l'shono, yeda ki hu ger. Then the Jew will forget his roots. He'll consider himself a secure citizen in the diaspora, believing that Berlin is Jerusalem. Then there will come a tempest, a storm, when Jews will be uprooted from their homes, and they will realize that they are indeed strangers in these lands. These prophetic words were written by Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk in his landmark work, the Meshach Chochma. It was written just a few years before he died, and he died in 1926. He was commenting on the words of the Tochacha, of the admonition found in the 26th parak of Vayikra in Parshat Bechukotai. And the words, indeed prophetic, coming when they did, are chilling. As only a few years before Hitler, Yamach Shemo, his rise to power in Germany. And the words, unfortunately, they haunt me till this day. And they are words that should haunt you as well. The topic I chose for this morning's shiur, this lecture, was actually born of a comment that was made to me some years ago here in Yerushalayim. A friend of mine, a fellow minionaire, turned to me on a Motzai Shabbat before the 3 weeks. And he, following the tefillah, he commented on the approaching 3 weeks. And he said to me, Rabbi, I just can't get into them. I have a difficulty fasting on Tisha B'Av. I mean, difficulty in understanding why I should fast on Tisha B'Av. Listen, he explained, listen. I wake up, I look around me, I see the construction taking place throughout Yerushalayim. I see a once sleepy village of the 18th century that now boasts almost a million residents. Each morning, I gaze at the beautiful skyline of our city, and I see magnificent structures standing next to restored historical sites. I walk through the old city, and I see a city rebuilt from the ashes, from the destruction of 2,000 years ago and 19 years of Jordanian control. And I am supposed to fast and cry over destruction of Yerushalayim. I'm expected to tearfully wail about as the tefillah in the Shemona Esrei on Tisha B'Av states, Ha'ir ha'avela ha'chareva ha'bezuya ha'shomema. Oh, I wail and cry over the city that mourns and is destroyed and is scorned and is desolate. I'm sorry, he said. I just find that far too difficult to do because I live here and I look around. After all, he asked, why must we fast? And his question was a fair one. It really was. After one, we should not be guilty of trespassing a prohibition. It's an Isser in the Torah. Midvar sheker tirchak. It's the only mitzvah from which the Torah says you must distance yourself from it. And that is the Isur, the sin of sheker, of telling a lie. Wouldn't such a description of Yerushalayim of today be a false description? How can we, therefore, continue to mourn, to fast, when the situation today, thank God, is so different from the previous centuries? Was my friend correct in questioning our continued fasting? So let me first clarify that he was not the first one to ask that question. I recall that soon after the Six-Day War in 1967, people all over the world asked the question, especially here in Israel. There was even a Tisha B'Av book, a keynote book, that came out with a revised text for Nachem, blessing, so we don't have to say those words. And he omitted all of the references to a desolate or destroyed or scorned city. He focused rather on the mourning and the Jewish martyrs over the centuries, which is not completely what Tisha B'Av is about. And I recall too at the time, as I was in the yeshiva, the Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal strongly opposed any such changes in the text. And yet, many still support such revisions, and indeed, they say these different Nachem prayers. I recall, in fact, a number of years ago, I was attending a Shabbat bar mitzvah outside of Yerushalayim with friends of ours. And at the end of the tefillah, and this is, I believe, a little after Pesach, or maybe right before the summertime, after the tefillah, the president of the shul announced that there was going to be a meeting of the Vaad. The members would vote on whether or not to retain the traditional Nachem Tfilah on Tisha B'Av, or replace it with a newer version. So you see, people are still asking, why must we fast and mourn over Yerushalayim today? Well, that question was not only said a few years ago at the Bar Mitzvah. I have news for you. The same question was posed, 2,500 years ago. And it was posed to Zechariah HaNavi and the Kohanim. It was during the time that they were first rebuilding the second Beit HaMikdash. And the Navi tells us and records this following statement, an event. Vayehi bishnat arba l'daryov ha-shamelach hayad v'ashem el Zechariah ba'arba'a l'chodesh ha-tshi'i b'kislev. God speaks to Zechariah on the fourth day of Kislev. Vayishlach Beit El Saretzer v'regem melech v'anashav l'chalot epnei Hashem. He sent they sent certain representatives to go to the Beit HaMikdash, which is being built, to pray to God, Lemor, to ask the question to the Kohanim and to the Navi, of course. Lemor la Kohanim asher lebeit Hashem tzvakot ve'el ha-Neviyim Lemor. What was their question? Ha'evkeh b'chodesh ha-chabishi, hinazer ka'asher asiti zeh kama shanim. Should I weep in the fifth month? The fifth month is the month of Av. Should we weep on Tisha B'Av? Should I abstain from the physical pleasures, that is, some eating, as I have been doing for these past many years? These people who sent the message were living in Bavel, in a diaspora, in Golos. And they were living there a generation after the return to Jerusalem. And they sent a letter and representatives to ask the Shaila to the Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash. The question was, should we still fast? Should we still mourn? I mean, after all, we're back in Jerusalem again. I mean, we're not, but the Jews have come back to Jerusalem. And look, they're rebuilding the temple once more. So why are we still fasting? My friend posed the exact same question to me a few years ago. And it is a question that obviously has been repeated over the centuries. Even as far back as 2,500 years ago, which was the last time that Jews returned to the land, till, of course, 1948. At the time that the question was posed to me, I couldn't respond immediately. Not because I had no answer, but because there were so many thoughts and answers that were butterflying in my mind that I simply was without any response. So if I may say, this talk today is somewhat of an outlet for me and my frustration for not answering then, because this is what I should have said. First and foremost, changing millennia-old customs and traditional texts is not something to be taken lightly. For any individual to add his own prayer, as beautiful and as meaningful as it might be, but to add it to a communal service, not a private service, but to add that his shul should say it also, is to take upon one's shoulders responsibility that rests only with the rabbinic high courts, such as the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who established the tefillah as it is. For example, we include, hopefully in all Batei Knesset, but I'll say most Batei Knesset, the recently composed Tfilah L'Shlom Hamdina. We've added that to our communal prayer because it was instituted not by one or not by two, but by the chief rabbinate of Israel in 1949, the highest ranking rabbinical authority and the rabbinical body that exists at the time. It is for that reason that I am personally very uncomfortable with those who take it upon themselves, you know, to tweak that prayer as well. I've heard of different people just changing words here and there. For example, instead of saying Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, that may Israel be the first flowering of our redemption, they say Shetehei, let it be the first flowering of our redemption, almost as if expressing doubt as to whether the events of the last 100 plus years were truly divinely ordained or just coincidence. And just as I am uncomfortable with those who want to remove the words Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, I am also uncomfortable with those who want to actually remove them in favor of saying Shehi Geulatenu, the state of Israel, which is the Geula. It may be true, but who has the authority to do that? Not you and not me, and not one person, but only an authority, a rabbinic authority, that can establish such practices throughout the land. We must take care, very simply, to change any text established by any authoritative rabbinic body, because we don't tinker with the prayers so that they fit into our worldview at this point. It's a divisive act that only would only further divide us, unfortunately. And that's why we don't change prayers or customs so easily. And that too is why we continue to fast. Now, I have other reasons. The second reason, and equally important, I must say, is a reason that's given to us by Chazal as to why we fast. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of our sins. And tomorrow's fast of Asara B'Tevet is the first in the cycle of fasts marking the sequence of events that led to Churban Bayit. And the question we have is, have we repaired those sins already? May I recommend to you a lovely article called Probing the Prophets in the Torah Tidbits of about this week's Vayigash and that of Torah, because I there propose that Sinat Chinam was not the only sin, was not a sin that caused the destruction of only the Second Temple. But I dare say it was crucially involved also in the destruction of the First Temple. Sin was Sinat Chinam. Have we rid ourselves of it, of a Lashon Hara? Do we no longer find joy or satisfaction when those who disagree with us, whether it's politically, whether it's religiously, whether it's philosophically, when they are shamed or defeated? Have you listened to the news channels lately? If you're lucky, you didn't. Have you read the newspapers? Do you listen to political debates? Do you watch the demonstrations or the violence poured out against those who defend our borders and those who look to enforce the law and keep our streets peaceful? Have you seen what they're doing? We've gotten rid of our Sinat Chinam. We no longer hate each other. If we have not removed these sins from our personalities and from our society, then that is enough reason to mourn and to fast. That's the precise reason that the rabbis tell us in the Gemara that any generation in which the temple was not rebuilt must regard itself as a generation in which the temple was destroyed. Because if we had improved our ways and we had removed that Sinat Chinam and that Lashon Hara, then the Holy Temple would have been built already, and it's not. And for that reason as well, we fast. Thirdly, we should not forget that these fasts, though they are rabbinically ordained, have their roots in the Tanakh itself. How many of us are aware of that? I quoted before from Zechariah. So the fasts here date back to the time of the Nevi'im. Nobody has gone around deciding they should do away with the Hoshana Rabbah and the hitting of the Aravot against the ground. It's a strange ritual, one would imagine, in the 21st century. But no one says, let's not do it. Why? It's a Minhag Nevi'im. We have a Minhag Nevi'im, these four fasts. And if they date back to the time of the prophets, and they were observed, that means, by the Nevi'im, by the prophets and their contemporaries, even before the destruction of Beit Mikdash Sheni, the second temple, this was done as mourning for the first temple's destruction. If that's how, where it goes back to, then do we have the right to say, nah, I'm not going to do it. No reason to. The quotation that I gave you before actually continues, and it continues the following way. God answers that question. And he promises then that when the time comes, Tzom HaRavi'i, V'tzom HaChamishi, V'tzom HaShavi'i, V'tzom HaAsiri Yihyu, Levet Yehuda, L'Sason, U'L'Simcha, U'L'Moadim Tovim. That the four fast days will become days of joy and celebration. What will it mean if we do not observe the fast of the Revi'i, the fourth month? That's Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, and the fifth month, Tisha B'Av, and the seventh month, Tzom Gedalia, and yes, the 10th month, Asara B'Tevet. What days would God then make into days of joy and celebration for us? Remember the words of Yeshayahu HaNavi in the very last parak of Yeshayahu. Simchu et Yerushalayim v'gilu ba kol ohaveha asisu itam asos kol hamit ablim aleha. That all those who mourn over the destruction of Jerusalem yet rejoice over its construction. So if we stop mourning over Jerusalem, what then? And Chazal go even further. They state, Kol hamit abel al Yerushalayim zocher ro'eh bivinyana. Those who mourn over the loss of Yerushalayim will yet live to see its building and its reconstruction. Do we not realize that the thousands of years of fasting and crying that implanted into the heart of every Jew the thirst for Tzion, that yearning for our homeland that was rekindled four times a year, five times a year at least, that yearning for a homeland, that love of Eretz Yisrael, well, that's what made it possible. That's what made it possible, even for the secular Jew, even for the suffering East European Jew, to reject Uganda as a home and demand Tzion, Zion. And Menachem Weizmann and his followers from the Polish Zionist community that appeared at that congressional, it's not congressional, the Zionist Congress, and Herzl gave them this option. It was a time of the pogroms, as we'll see, thinking that they would grab onto it. It was they, the suffering Jews, who stood up and demanded, no, we will only accept Zion. What gave them that tie, even if they weren't religious? Because they were still fasting. Because there was still a Tisha B'Av and an Asara B'Tevet. Because every Jew understood what that loss meant. These people, they yearned for the land, they cried for it, mourned for it, and yes, fasted for it. Should we also ignore that? And that too is a reason why we are still fasting. But it is the fourth argument that I really should have used when I was answering my friend, and the one that I really want to discuss with you today. There is a simple fact that pains me no end. Too many Jews no longer perceive Gullus as the divine punishment. It's not regarded as a tragedy that it has been and that it was meant to be. Today it seems diaspora is good. Exile is fine. Gullus is fun. I shudder when I read of what is happening all over the world today. University campuses have become hotbeds of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. They have become a dangerous place for the young Jew, especially for Jewish Zionists. And it rips my heart out that I think of my students from long ago, well, maybe 6-7 years ago at least, and beyond that, 37 years before that, that these young men and women go to universities where it's a very dangerous thing to be a Zionist, to be a Jew. And how does that impact their view of Israel and of Judaism when at a very impressionable age, they are given all of this hatred and all of this misinformation, both on campus and in the classroom? It's dangerous to be a Zionist, to be a Jew. Who remembers the amount of anti-Semitic attacks in Gullus all around the world has increased to the point where they now account for the highest number of racial attacks in the world. No minority, no race is attacked more than the Jewish race. That's today. That's in 2020, soon to be 21. Kosher Shechita has just been banned in Belgium. And by the way, they weren't the first ones, together with other European countries that have democratic European countries that have banned Shechita. My goodness, it has even become dangerous to look Jewish in the street of Paris, or even to be a beauty king queen who actually had a Jewish father. And we are seeing the greatest, the highest rate of anti-Semitism in America since the Holocaust. But Golis is great, isn't it? It's terrific. So why should we fast? In 1923, after the Balfour Declaration had been issued, which was in November 2nd in 1917, after the Ottoman Empire had been removed from the land and the British had opened doors for Jewish immigration before they closed them in 1939, especially with the White Paper. But at that time, Chaim Weizmann was absolutely shocked over the lack of Aliyah, especially from these suffering Eastern European communities of he was once a part. You see, the Jewish settlement of Palestine, as envisioned by Herzl, was primarily meant for the Jewish communities suffering under the oppressive rule of Eastern European powers. That's why he suggested Uganda for them. Herzl himself never saw Palestine to be his homeland, or at least a place he would live, because he had a very good reason. He lived under the enlightened cultures of Western Europe. You know, those wonderful cultures, democratic cultures like Austria-Hungary, oh, Germany, France, where the Dreyfus trial and the accompanying anti-Semitism that made Herzl write Der Judenstaat and found the Zionist movement. You know, those wonderful countries that would never be anti-Semitic, they don't need a Palestine. They don't need a Zion. But those poor Jews in Eastern Europe, they need it. And they did need it. As we'll see, there were pogroms going on. That, in his view, was what Zion was meant for. Otherwise, Golis is fine. The poor Jews of Eastern Europe, the Jews of Russia, Poland, and the Ukraine, they suffered terribly. Even as late as the 20th century, after Herzl had passed on, pogroms were unleashed against Jews in Kishinev, in Kiev, in Berdichev, in Prokhorov. This is the 20th century. We're not talking about the 16th century. In the 20th century, I often tell my class in history a simple fact that I still find so shocking that I repeat it, maybe to like pinching yourself to reality. In the 20th century, during the Ukrainian Civil War, there were 326 pogroms unleashed against the Jews in the Ukraine alone. And the shock that I had is not that number alone. In those pogroms, 70,000 Jews were murdered. How many of you have heard that? How many of you knew that there were 70,000 Jews who were murdered in the 1920s? And you haven't heard that. You know why? Because 6 million is a bigger number. But that's what Golis brings us. It's a great place to be, isn't it? Wonderful. Welcome to Golis. At any rate, understandably, Weizmann in 1923 couldn't believe that these suffering Jews didn't find their way to Palestine. He was disappointed by the lack of aliyah, of excitement from these suffering communities. And in a famous statement he publicly pronounced, he said, "Jews, where are you?" And yet I can understand the reluctance of the Jews at that time to come to Palestine. And after all, serious questions faced them. What was there in Palestine for them? Now, the doors for immigration were opened in the United States. They could immigrate there. And indeed, this is an important little fact to know and understand and appreciate. Between the years of about 1882 and 1921-22, 2 million Russian Jews, should I say make Aliyah? They didn't make Aliyah, but they came to the United States and were taken in by the United States. 2 million Russian Jews. How many made it to Palestine? Not many. A slow trickle of idealistic young Russians made their way to Palestine. Who could blame them? How could the Jews expect protect themselves from the Arab pogroms that had begun? How would they support their families? What economy was there here? And what type of religious life was there for them? They had serious and really understandable hesitations in coming to Palestine. That's why so many didn't. But today, at a time when Jews here in Israel make up 70%+ of the population, when the dream of 2,000 years has been realized with the establishment of an independent Jewish state of Israel, when economic opportunities, that they are abound, and religious life flourishes as never before, and not even in Holy Europe. There's more Torah being taught and learned in this country between the internet and the real Shiurim and the OU. More Torah being learned than any time in Europe, maybe in all of Europe put together in all the years. And we have to ask. We have to ask, therefore, like Weizmann did, Jews, where are you? Some years ago, in the middle of the Second Intifada, there was a group of dedicated Zionists from America who traveled to Israel. And I say dedicated because it was a time where there was not much tourism. I know that because I was able to bring a group about two, three times actually during those years to visit Israel also in the summer. One of those groups did come, and the time when, as I said, tourism was suffering terribly. And they did so in order to give encouragement, let alone also monetary support, to their brethren, real chizuk. They spent the Shabbat in a community that was made up actually by majority of Anglo-Jews, mostly from the United States, some from other English-speaking countries. And they spent the afternoon in a wonderful sit-down with these people. And the local residents shared with them the love of the town they lived in and the life in Israel, and how wonderful and wonderful it was that they had made the Aliyah. And in response, one of the American visitors raised his hand and he stood up. He said, look, to be honest, he said, I really do regard you very highly. I think it's wonderful that you've made that sacrifice. That's the word he used. He said, but to be honest, I don't know why I should consider Aliyah. I have a wonderful life where I live. We have kosher restaurants, kosher caterers, kosher supermarkets, wonderful shiurim with great rabbanim and terrific schools. What do you have here that I don't have at home? Because diaspora is good. Gullus is fun and it's fine. Simply, too many Jews today don't accept the tragedy that is the exile. Oh, everything is fine here. What do you have in Israel that we don't have at home? And that alone is enough reason to have us fasting and mourning and crying when Gullus becomes your home, when Berlin becomes Jerusalem. And connected with this fourth argument, Rav Soloveitchik, as I mentioned before, when he opposed the changes in the Nachem Bracha on Tisha B'Av, he gave an additional explanation as to why he was against it. He said, whenever we speak about the destroyed Yerushalayim, we don't refer to the city alone, not at all. He explained, and he brings it from the Rambam, that Yerushalayim, when it says it's defined by the Beit HaMikdash. And as long as the Beit HaMikdash remains unbuilt, We consider the entire city as desolate, destroyed, scorned. And if many of our people can say, what do you have here that I don't have back home? And many can ask, why are we still fasting? Then it's clear that too many of our brethren have no idea what Geula would bring, of what redemption could truly, truly mean. And it explains why our people, both in Israel and abroad, why they say and ask, why do we have to rebuild a Beit HaMikdash? What do we need it for? So let me tell you a story. It's a story that happened to me about 20 years ago. Actually, it's about 25 years ago now. I was a rabbi in Fort Lee, New Jersey, in Bergen County. And the local Jewish community center, the JCC, sponsored a dialogue with rabbis of different denominations. And the dialogue was to be to respond to a simple question. Two questions, actually. Should we rebuild the Holy Temple? And if you believe it should be, what would its purpose be? Now, let me explain something personally. I don't like going into debates. I don't like going into dialogues. My perhaps limited intelligence or limited knowledge about certain things may be seen by others to be that's all we have, and reject my arguments for someone else's. It's a big responsibility. But I was so taken aback and really offended by the fact that the question to be asked, I decided that I would accept the invitation. And I began by commenting on how sad it was that we would ask such questions. Could you imagine, I told them, could you imagine such questions being debated and discussed at any other period in our long history? The Holy Temple is an anachronism. It doesn't belong now. It's unrealistic. It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable because we're so comfortable here in the diaspora that we don't even sense that we lack so much. We don't know what we're missing because Gullus is just great. So let me finish with a few words. The Gemara in Baba Basra shares this story. It says the following. Omar Rabba Bar Bar Chona, Zimna Chada Hava Ka'azlinan Bisfinta. Once we were sailing on a ship. V'chazina nahu kavra diyasfa le tilta agabe v'kadach agama iluya. And there we saw, actually, it was a big whale. But we didn't know that at the time, because on top of the back of the whale, there was land. And the people, the Kadach Agmale, there's pasture land, Greece, green grass. Savrina Nyabeshtahi. So we were sure this is dry land. It's an island. Nice place to visit. So Visalkinan, we got off the ship. Vafina Nubashlina Nagabe. And we had a barbecue. It was great. We baked on it and we cooked on it. It was a terrific picnic. But you know what? V'chad Cham Gabe. But when the back of the whale suddenly got hot, warm from the fires, Ishapich. The whale started turning over. And if our ship weren't nearby, we would have drowned because Babylonia was a whale. And America, a whale. And Germany is a whale. And all of Gullus is a whale. And one little thing. A new leader comes that didn't know what the good the Jews did. There was a Haman that comes, and he doesn't care what the Jews did. Suddenly the whale starts to turn over and almost drown all the Jews. And unless the Jews learn that they're living in the Golos on the back of a whale and they aren't home, oy vavoy. Oy vavoy, that's reason to fast. My friends, the Geula is not complete through our return to Israel alone. It's a beginning. It's Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. But as Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk concluded his warning with which I began, the conclusion was, he writes the following. V'yakir ki lishono sfat kodshenu. The Jew will finally learn when they thought Berlin was Yerushalayim and what happened to them there. They'll finally realize that the holy tongue, that's our language. Umachatzavtohu geza Yisrael. And you don't come from America, you don't come from Canada, you don't come from Mexico. You come from Israel. That's your roots. And he would be comforted from God's prophecies, asher nibu, that were given over by our prophets, be it orer beregesh kodesh. And such a person in that time will be filled with a holy spirit, a holy feeling, uvanav yasu chayil b'torat Hashem asher nishkacha. And his children, that next generation, will learn Torah like never before. The Torah that has been forgotten over all of the years. They'll produce so much, you can open the internet and find anywhere, anything you want. That's what's going to happen, he predicts back in the 1920s, before the 1920s, of what will be. And then, Pazeh, Yitchayim v'yichazek ometz. That's what will give him strength. What will give him the courage. You see, my friends, there is still more we must do. We still must improve. We still must learn. And we still must understand why we still must fast. Thank you, and have a meaningful fast tomorrow.